Good afternoon, and welcome to the reading of the Waterloo Cedar Falls, The Courier. It's Monday, September 13th. I'm your reader, Bob Young. Let's take a quick look at the weather today. The Courier is forecasting a blend of sun and clouds today, with winds from the southeast between 7 and 14 miles per hour. Our high will be 81 degrees, and tonight down to 64 degrees, and it will be cloudy with a stray thunderstorm here and there. Winds will move to the south-southwest, 6 to 12 miles per hour. Looking at our lead stories on the front page, vulnerable Democrats push local priorities in budget. Taliban, women can study in college. Pandemic fuels suicide concerns. And let's begin reading the lead story, museum piece. Mason City exhibit now features rare Colby auto engine. This story was filed by Jared McNett of the Mason City Globe Gazette and begins with a photograph of Lloyd Van Horn, and he's standing beside an engine on display whose identification plate indicates it was built in 1913, which he recently donated to Kenny Pioneer Museum in Mason City. Mason City. At the time, the Colby Motor Company shut down its plant in 1914, about 4 years after cars first rolled off an assembly line in Mason City, the business had purportedly managed to sell about 1,000 automobiles for anywhere from $1,400 to $1,800. For years now, the Kenny Pioneer Museum, located near the Mason City Municipal Airport, has had what it touts as the only remaining Colby car, a 1911 Roadster that would have been made near 19th Street Southwest. This summer, museum treasurer John Barron said that he got a call from someone who wanted to know if the Kenny Pioneer Museum would be interested in bolstering the four-wheel piece of Mason City history with a complete Colby engine and transmission. Quote, "They've got the Colby car out there, so I thought they ought to have a spare engine, so they can get a good look at it," said Lloyd Van Horn, who operated the Van Horn Truck Museum in the Mason City area for 18 years. Over time, Van Horn's collection has included the only known 1912 American-made Sauer, a Swiss brand, a 1923 Model T Ford factory conversion snowmobile with skis, and, eventually, a Colby engine with the transmission. Some he came by through auctions, and others through informal negotiations over a 3-year time span. The latter method is how Van Horn acquired the Colby. According to Van Horn, a gentleman wanted to sell him a Colby truck, which included the engine and transmission. However, Van Horn insisted that the brainchild of William Colby never actually produced trucks, and that what the man had was a homemade rig of sorts. Eventually, Van Horn said the gentleman conceded. Quote, he said, "I won't sell you just the engine," Van Horn relayed. Once he got it, Van Horn refurbished the engine himself, and Barron said that it looks like it would have the day it went into a Colby car. When Barron got the call, he said Van Horn asked him plainly, quote, "I've got the engine. Would you like to have it?" unquote. The local historian said yes, and now the museum has a new piece on display that Barron said can serve as a tie-in with the Colby car. Quote, "People can see things up close and personal as it sits on a frame. They can see how it started. It's kind of a tie-in for people to see an industry in Mason City and that particular engine in its entirety," Barron said. Along with the engine and the transmission, Barron said that Van Horn provided a framed photo of some industrious men working, men who may well have had a hand in crafting a Colby or one of its engines. Per a 2002 article in the Globe Gazette by Kristen Boehner, the Colby plant was shut down in 1914 and went into receivership in 1915. An auction was held May 26, 1915, to raise money to pay off the estimated 100 to 200 creditors. A sale bill for that auction listed, among other things, radiators, auto frames, 25 auto bodies, springs, 9 partially completed automobiles, 10 mohair touring car tops, gasoline tanks, mufflers, windshields, numerous other auto parts, office furniture, and one sewing machine. Our next story was filed by Andy Milone, and it's titled Pandemic Fuels Suicide Concerns, How Cedar Valley Mental Health Advocates Think Suicide Rate Will Change, Waterloo. Tom Yukas, executive director of the Black Hawk Grundy Mental Health Center, is surprised there has not been a huge spike in the area suicide rate during the COVID-19 pandemic. But that hasn't lessened his concern about a possible rise in numbers in the future because of the corresponding surges that have followed past crises. Think the SARS epidemic, Ebola virus, Great Depression, Great Recession, or any disaster, he says. Yukas is sounding the alarm about how he thinks the suicide rate could end up heading in the wrong direction at a time when he has seen a significant increase in the number of people requesting services from the mental health center he has led since 1993. Quote, I think people are tired of the uncertainty, he said. I think they are tired of the isolation. I think they are tired of wearing masks. I think they are tired of not being able to do what they used to do in life. And the pandemic is still alive and well. So I think the anxiety and stress leads to depression, and suicide is the end result of people that are depressed. Depression is one of the main factors in suicides. There is an increase in people saying, quote, I don't know what to do about this. I need help. But what makes it more challenging for the leaders trying to help these people is the huge workforce shortage in Iowa. Quote, we have 4 open therapist positions at the mental health center and no candidates, he said in an interview earlier this month. Quote, you can have the world's best evidence-based practices, but if you don't have the staff to carry out those treatments, it doesn't matter, unquote. Asked about the reason behind the workforce shortage, he replied, I've been looking for that answer for a while. UNI has a counseling program and a social work program that churn out a lot of people every year, but I don't know where they're going, unquote. Suicide is a top 10 leading cause of death in Iowa, according to the CDC. But Yukas says among people ages 15 to 44, it is second. Quote, over the last 20 years, the suicide rate in the United States has increased, he said. But I'm not sure how accurate the reporting is, because suicide is still somewhat invisible. I'm not sure how many obituaries you see in the paper that said somebody committed suicide, unquote. Iowa Public Health Tracking Portal reports Black Hawk County had 23 and 14 suicides in 2019 and 2020, respectively, in Iowa. The numbers have risen every year since 2014. Data are not available for 2021. Decades ago, Iowa was not known positively for its mental health programs. According to Yukas, the National Treatment Advocacy Center gave Iowa an F in 1990 for the services it provided. But that was a long time ago. More recently, a global spotlight has been flashed on the importance of someone's well-being beyond their physical health. In 2014, the Cedar Valley Coalition on Suicide Prevention and Support was founded with a federal grant awarded to the University of Northern Iowa. The community became involved, and when the grant expired 3 years later, there was enough support from organizations like the Black Hawk County Grundy Mental Health Center to keep the mission alive. More than 100 individuals, agencies, and organizations in the health, law enforcement, corrections, and political spheres met the second Tuesday of every month from 7 to 8 a.m. to discuss what more can be done. Quote, last year, we were fortunate to get a grant from Community Foundation of Northeast Iowa to accomplish several things with our coalition, Yukas said. With the funding, he says the coalition purchased 400 gun locks, trained more than 500 people in a suicide prevention program, QPR, question, persuade, refer, and advertised on billboards in more rural areas to try and make those remote populations more of the resources available. Ryan Nesbitt raises awareness about suicide through his nonprofit Alive and Running Iowa, which he co-founded with a friend after they lost a Dunkerton High School classmate to suicide. He is equally worried about a suicide trend that might emerge in the near future. Quote, thinking about post-pandemic people like myself are on high alert because we are very concerned based on history, he said in a telephone interview. Quote, traditionally, in the United States, when we have wars, pandemics, or any similar major event, usually the suicide rate skyrockets after that. The Jessup resident says Alive and Running Iowa is focused on educating youths to, quote, keep them alive and enjoying life. After his best friend, a high schooler, took his own life, he developed a passion for helping struggling teenagers. Nesbitt is surprised by the sheer number of people struggling with their mental health. His schedule is packed this fall with classes he will teach and presentations he will give to high school and middle school students in districts like the South Winneshe Community School District and Dunkerton Community School District, but also to professionals like teachers, nurses, and EMTs. When he sticks around after a session, he knows more people are struggling because of the number of them who approach him afterward to talk one-on-one about themselves, a friend, or a family member. Quote, education is crucial. It is important that people know how to help other people, he noted for a similar reason as Yukas. Quote, there are not enough experts, counselors, therapists, and doctors for the amount of people that need help, unquote. Quote, we all have to play a role, and that's why education is crucial, he added. For kids, social media and pressure are some of the big culprits. Quote, you should take college classes in high school. I like that, but kids are taking too many, he said. Quote, they're missing out on their youth. It's a race to get my BA and my master's, and then you're 22 and you realize you didn't have much fun over the past 6 years. It's this race to get a career, and you're missing all the fun parts of life and the athletics. There's so much pressure to the point where it's not even fun, and it has become year-round pressure, unquote. Another challenge is the rural nature of Iowa, he said, and how someone struggling could be miles away from counselors and have no way to see him or her. Telehealth is an option, but not always preferred. Quote, if you're ever struggling, don't be afraid to ask for help, he said. That is not a sign of weakness. It's actually a sign of strength to ask for help. For anyone who is living a great life and has no worries, you can volunteer any time or donate money to help other people, unquote. The next story was filed by Kathy Gannon of the Associated Press. Taliban say women can study in gender-segregated universities. Kabul, Afghanistan. Women in Afghanistan can continue to study in universities, including at postgraduate levels, but classrooms will be gender-segregated and Islamic dress is compulsory, the Taliban government's new higher education minister said Sunday. The announcement came as a Taliban official said Qatar's foreign minister arrived in the Afghan capital of Kabul, the highest level visitor since the Taliban announced their interim cabinet. There was no immediate confirmation of the visit by Qatari officials. Earlier Sunday, the higher education minister, Abdul Baghi Haghani, laid out a new policies as a news conference several days after Afghanistan's new rulers formed an all-male government. On Saturday, the Taliban had raised their flag over the presidential palace, signaling the start of the work of the new government. The world has been watching closely to see to what extent the Taliban might act differently from their first time in power in the late 1990s. During that era, girls and women were denied an education and were excluded from public life. The Taliban have suggested they have changed, including in their attitudes toward women. However, women have been banned from sports, and the Taliban have used violence in recent days against women protesters demanding equal rights. Haghani said the Taliban did not want to turn the clock back 20 years. We will start building on what exists today, he said. However, female university students will face restrictions, including a compulsory dress code. Haghani said hijabs will be mandatory, but did not specify if this meant compulsory headscarves or also compulsory face coverings. Gender segregation will also be enforced, he said. Quote, we will not allow boys and girls to study together, he said. We will not allow co-education, unquote. Haqqani said the subjects being taught would also be reviewed. While he did not elaborate, he said he wanted graduates of Afghanistan's universities to be competitive with the university graduates in the region and the rest of the world. The Taliban, who subscribed to a strict interpretation of Islam, banned music and art during their previous time in power. This time around, television has remained, and news channels still show women presenters, but the Taliban messaging has been erratic. In an interview on Afghanistan's popular TOLO News, or Tolo News, Taliban spokesman Saeed Zakarullah Hashimi said last week that women should give birth and raise children. While the Taliban have not ruled out the eventual participation of women in the government, the spokesman said, quote, it's not necessary that women be in the cabinet, unquote. The Taliban seized power on August 15th, the day they overran Kabul after capturing outlying provinces in a rapid military campaign. They initially promised inclusiveness and a general amnesty for their former opponents, but many Afghans remain deeply fearful of the new rulers. Taliban police officials have beaten Afghan journalists, violently dispersed women's protests, and formed an all-male government, despite saying initially they would invite broader representation. The new higher education policy signals a change from the accepted practice before the Taliban takeover. Universities were co-ed, with men and women studying side by side, and female students did not have to abide by a dress code. However, the vast majority of female university students opted to wear headscarves in line with tradition. In elementary and high school, boys and girls were taught separately even before the Taliban came to power. In high schools, girls had to wear tunics reaching to their knees, and white headscarves and jeans, makeup, and jewelry were not permitted. Taliban political spokesman Suhai Shaheen tweeted Sunday about the Qatar delegation, saying it included Shakish Mohammed bin Abdur Rahman Al Thani, the deputy prime minister, who was also Qatar's foreign minister. The Qatari foreign minister met with Taliban Prime Minister Mohammed Hassan Akhund, Shaheen said. The Qatari delegation also met with former President Hamid Karzai and Abdullah Abdullah, the previous government's chief negotiator, in peace talks with the Taliban. The Taliban have maintained a political office in the Qatar capital of Doha since 2013. Last week, Qatar Airways became the first international airline to begin operating international flights out of Kabul Airport, transporting more than 250 foreign nationals, including U.S. citizens, out of the capital. Qatar has also provided technical assistance, along with Turkey, to restart the airport, which had been damaged by departing U.S. troops who left Afghanistan on August 30 after evacuating tens of thousands of Afghans fleeing the Taliban. Next, in a story filed by Thomas Beaumont of the Associated Press, vulnerable Democrats push for local priorities in budget. Des Moines, U.S. Representative Cindy Axne of Iowa was slow to get behind a $1 trillion infrastructure bill after the Senate passed it last month. It wasn't the price tag that tripped up the Democrat from a swing House district. It was that none of the money was targeted for a home state industry, ethanol and biodiesel. Axne set out to fix that. In the weeks since, she won assurances from congressional leaders that a separate multi-trillion dollar budget blueprint would include money for the renewable fuels. She's now on board. Her biofuels bargain underscores the political strategy embedded in the negotiations over massive new federal spending. And at this point in the article, we see a photograph of Representative Cindy Axne wearing a face mask. While Democrats have set out to pass ambitious bills with historic expansions of the social safety net and long-sought new programs, that's not how many politically vulnerable Democrats, such as Axne, are selling them at home. For them, Washington's spending boom has become a chance to deliver the goods and win headlines and perhaps bipartisan support in their districts. Quote, if she wants to get elected next time, this is her political bread and butter, Ray Gasser, a Republican farmer in Axne's district and past candidate for Iowa Secretary of Agriculture, said about her work to secure money for biofuels. Quote, for my part, I appreciate her approach, unquote. Representative Angie Craig of Minnesota has taken a similar tack. Craig, whose district includes vast tracts of farmland southeast of the Twin Cities, is promoting her role, securing a $2.5 billion for farmers and rural small business to convert to renewable energy sources and high-efficiency equipment as a financial incentive to meet higher environmental standards. She tweeted on Friday that she was, quote, thrilled that this longtime priority of mine would be supporting family farmers and driving investment across rural America, unquote. In Virginia, Representative Abigail Spanberger said she is chiefly focused on a measure to exempt her district's small-scale farmers and foresters from an increase in the estate tax, which President Joe Biden has proposed to help pay for the $3.5 trillion bill. Though Spanberger's constituents are concentrated in suburban Richmond, the district stretches north and south across the rolling agricultural Piedmont and its many dairy, vegetable, and cattle farms and private forest land. Quote, I've been very focused on making sure we're protecting small family farmers and foresters, certainly across central Virginia, Spanberger told the Associated Press. The lawmakers' efforts are aimed at assisting rural America, where Democrats have steadily lost votes over the past decade. The party is clear-eyed about needing to at least trim its losses in these areas if they are to hold the congressional seats and control of the House in 2022. Democrats currently have a mere 8-seat majority. Republicans are targeting roughly 30 House seats, where Democrats won by fewer than 10 percentage points in 2020. Axne, Spanberger, and Craig each won by no more than 2 percentage points. Quote, there's been a very deliberate effort to think about these provisions in ways that would be beneficial to rural communities, said Democratic pollster Jeff Guerin, who is advising the party on the budget package. Republicans argue that the size of the spending bill will turn off rural voters in key districts, not attract support. Quote, rural voters are incredibly concerned about the reckless spending and massive tax hikes that will be included in the Democrats' reconciliation bill, said Mike Berg, a spokesman for the National Republican Congressional Committee. Quote, if Democrats think these voters' concerns will be mollified by a few kickbacks from the federal government, they are sorely mistaken, unquote. The trillion-dollar infrastructure bill, a plan for roads, bridges, public transit, and broadband internet, passed the Democrat-controlled Senate with bipartisan support last month. The bill that includes extended child tax credits, expanded Medicare coverage, tuition-free community college, and other social and environmental programs. Pelosi has set the ambitious goal of passing it by October 1st. Axne announced on Wednesday that the draft of the House budget bill would include $1 billion to expand retail availability of ethanol and biodiesel around the country. Iowa leads the nation producing ethanol, a corn-based fuel additive, and biodiesel, commonly made from soybeans. The amount is double what Axne sought in a bill she had introduced in the House Agriculture Committee this year. The grants are expected to increase demand for the fuels nationally, spur output in Iowa's 42 ethanol plants and biodiesel refineries, as well as boost the price of corn and soybeans for the farmers who supply them, according to Iowa renewable fuels advocates. Quote, it impacts the price of soybeans by more than a dollar a bushel. "That's a lot of money," said Monty Shaw, executive director of the Iowa Renewable Fuels Association and a past Republican candidate for Congress. Quote, "For ethanol, you're looking at an extra $400 to $500 million for farmers in Iowa because the price of corn is higher. On top of that, for the fraction of the cost of the overall bill, the measure would immediately accelerate cutting carbon emissions, a priority of Biden's plan," Axne said. Quote, "There's no way that we're going to have everybody driving electric vehicles overnight," Axne said in a recent AP interview. Quote, "So why the heck are we not, if our goal is to impact climate in a positive way, blending more biofuels now so we can automatically lower greenhouse gases," unquote. It's also a relatively small price for a House seat, critical to Democrats' chances at holding the majority. Axne holds the distinction of winning by the smallest margin, 1.4 percentage points, of any Democrat in a district carried by Republican Donald Trump last year. Last year, the former state government administrator and small business owner from suburban Des Moines won Polk County, home to Des Moines and most of its suburbs, but lost the district's other 15 counties. Like Spanberger's advocacy for rural Virginians, Axne's emphasis on an economic priority in the GOP-leaning geographic majority of her district could trim her losses in rural Iowa next year. There will be other factors, of course. Biden's overall approval rating, now down after criticism for the chaotic recent U.S. withdrawal from Afghanistan and surging COVID-19 cases, is likely to play a major role, and any number of factors will emerge before an election still almost 17 months away. Still, Axne's first step success is a good sign for her, said Shaw, the Republican renewable fuels advocate. Quote, "I hate to ever say one thing makes or breaks somebody, but there are times when you have a chance to make a difference, and that's where the rubber meets the road," he said. Quote, "Ultimately, we need folks who can deliver," unquote. The next story was filed by the Associated Press. Cedar Rapids Hospitals restricting admissions for elective procedures. Cedar Rapids, hospitals in Iowa's second largest city, are limiting elective procedures because of increased numbers of patients driven partly by the surge in COVID-19 admissions. Both Unity Point Health St. Luke's Hospital and Mercy Medical Center confirmed Friday their facilities are preserving capacity because of high patient counts in recent weeks. Cedar Rapids hospitals had not delayed or postponed elective surgeries and procedures since last fall. St. Luke's is limiting surgeries that require a hospital stay to 10 per day. Quote, "We continue to assess the situation daily as it remains a very fluid situation," St. Luke's spokeswoman Sarah Corizo said in an email. Mercy also is temporarily reducing the number of elective procedures that require hospital stays after surgery, officials confirmed. Quote, "It's a day-to-day decision based on census and affects only procedures that do not need to be done within the next 4 to 6 weeks," Mercy spokesman Mark Ware said in an email. The announcement comes as coronavirus cases, largely driven by the highly contagious Delta variant, have surged in the past month across the state. All 99 Iowa counties are currently experiencing high community transmission, according to the U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. You are listening to the reading of the Waterloo Cedar Falls, The Courier, for Monday, September 13th, on IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind. Now, since there are no obituaries in today's paper, let's continue our reading on the sports page. In college football, Iowa's defense dogged Iowa State all day long, filed by Steve Batterson, Ames, Iowa. 2 games into the season, Iowa's mutts are playing like top dogs. The Iowa defense did it again Saturday, riddling a ranked opponent for the second week in a row with multiple game-changing plays. The Hawkeyes turned 4 turnovers by Iowa State into 20 points that sent 10th-ranked Iowa on its way to a 27-17 victory over the ninth-ranked Cyclones at Jack Trice Stadium. Quote, "That's what we do at Iowa. We may not run the fastest 40s or jump the highest. We're mutts, but we get the job done," said linebacker Jack Campbell, who scored on a third-quarter fumble recovery that broke open a 14-10 game. The effort, three interceptions and fumble recovery, was an encore to a three-interception effort in the season-opening win over 17th-ranked Indiana. Quote, "That's the standard, what we expect from ourselves," said senior quarterback Matt Hankins, who picked off a pair of passes. The victory was the sixth straight in Cy-Hawk series for Iowa, and it followed a familiar format. The Hawkeyes played turnover-free football against their in-state rival for the fifth straight game and made ISU pay for nearly every mistake it made in the first-ever matchup between the programs when both were ranked in the top 10 nationally. Quote, "Credit Iowa, especially defensively," Cyclones coach Matt Campbell said. "They made some great plays on the ball," unquote. Campbell's scoop and score came after Justin Jacobs jarred the ball loose, allowing the junior linebacker from Cedar Falls to pick up and return it 5 yards following the first of three costly ISU mistakes in the quarter. Quote, "There's no secret formula. We play defense the way we play it. You're talking about two really good defenses out there," Iowa coach Kurt Ferentz said. Quote, "Every yard was hard. It was a tough game against a tough team. Turnovers, to me, are usually the result of someone being where they're supposed to be." Interceptions could position Caleb Shattuck to extend the Hawkeyes' 21-10 lead with a pair of field goals over a 7-minute stretch that followed Campbell's touchdown with 5:08 to go in the third. Quote, "I was just in the right place at the right time," Campbell said. "That was 10 other guys out there scraping and clawing. I was just blessed to be in the right spot," unquote. Quarterback Spencer Petras, who completed 11 of 21 passes for 106 of Iowa's 174 yards of offense, called the Hawkeyes' defensive work a dream. The dream played out repeatedly in the deciding third quarter. Quote, "Those guys go so hard, and they're great at making things happen," Petras said. "Even when we come up short on a drive, we know they'll have our backs," unquote. Two snaps after Campbell's score, linebacker Seth Benson intercepted a Brock Purdy pass and returned it 6 yards to the Iowa State 25-yard line. In a game which saw Iowa accumulate just 174 yards of offense, the Hawkeyes' ensuing drive stalled and Shattuck drilled a career-long 51-yard field goal. Hankins ended ISU's next possession with his second interception of the game, returning it 41 yards to the 22-yard line. The Hawkeyes marched to the ISU 3-yard line during an opening minutes of the fourth quarter before settling for a 22-yard field goal by Shattuck. Quote, "To come here and get a win against a great team like this, it felt good to help us get a big win," unquote, said Shattuck, the son of Jeff Shattuck, a 3-time All-Big 8 kicker for ISU. Short fields created by mistakes started to plague the Cyclones, who are 1-1, in the second quarter, facilitating the Hawkeyes' second win of the young season, although a drive over the final 1:01 of the opening half pulled Iowa State within 14-10 at the break. After Charlie Jones wrapped his arms around a 26-yard touchdown pass to give the Hawkeyes a 14-3 advantage, Purdy connected on 4 straight passes, including a 49-yard strike to Darren Wilson with 12 seconds to play in the second quarter. Following a timeout, Breece Hall plowed his way through the middle of the Iowa defense to collect a rushing touchdown for the 14th straight game, one shy of a Big 12 record. Quote, "That can't happen," Campbell said. "We talked as a defense at the half and made the adjustments we needed to make." Hall's 4-yard carry came after Iowa had scored twice in the second quarter, overcoming a lethargic start. The Hawkeyes accumulated just 14 yards of offense as the teams traded punts early and often in an opening quarter that ended with the Cyclones ahead 3-0 on the strength of a 23-yard field goal by Connor Asselay. Iowa's Suddock missed from 50 yards on the Hawkeyes' only scoring opportunity in the first quarter, following a low snap. A Hawkins interception set up the drive, which moved Iowa in front. Hawkins's pick at midfield preceded receptions by Jackson Ritter and Luke Latchey of 9 and 17 yards that marched Iowa to the 20-yard line. Four plays later, Tyler Goodson gave Iowa the lead with 8 minutes 13 remaining on a 4-yard run. A 26-yard punt by ISU's Corey Dunn positioned Iowa for its second touchdown of the quarter, Jones's first touchdown of the season, with 1 minute 1 second left in the half. Next, filed by Jim Nelson, UNI explodes in the second half behind Theo Day to beat Sac State. Sacramento, California. Northern Iowa trailed Sacramento State at halftime Saturday at Hornet Stadium. When the Panthers came out of the locker room for the second half, it was a brand new day. After getting only 7 passing yards from Will McIlvain in the first half, UNI switched to Michigan State transfer Theo Day to begin the second half. The end result was an offensive explosion. Day led the Panthers on 4 third-quarter touchdown drives as UNI rolled to a 34-16 victory. Quote, "Everybody played well," UNI coach Mark Farley said. Quote, "The running game was good, but for sure, Theo sparked the offense. He made some nice decisions," unquote. Trailing 9-7 at the break, the Panther defense forced a quick 3-and-out, and then on his second pass attempt, Day hit Isaiah Weston on a 48-yard pass play to set up a Tyler Hoosman 1-yard touchdown run to put UNI ahead it would never relinquish. It was an onslaught of offense and defense thereafter. Spencer Cuvillier's second fumble recovery of the game set up a Vance McShane 2-yard touchdown run, and then Day hit Weston on a 34-yard touchdown. To cap off the 27-point third quarter, Day hit Quan Hampton for a 9-yard score, 6 plays after Corby Sandler interception, and all of a sudden, it was 34-9. Day finished 6 of 11 for 120 yards, and he rushed 3 times for 14. UNI ran for 221 yards on 41 carries, as Dom Williams had 97 yards on 16 carries. McShane ran 10 times for 65 yards and his 2 scores. Weston had 3 catches for 92 yards. Quote, "The offense re-energized the whole team," Farley said. Quote, "It was amazing third quarter," Williams added. "It was a great feeling in the third quarter to score on all 4 of our possessions. Theo was very calm, just a natural leader, and he took control of the whole offense. It was good seeing him be patient for it to be his time," unquote. The defense forced 6 turnovers, 3 interceptions, Benny Sapp, Sandler, and Omar Brown, and 3 fumbles. Spencer Cuvillier recovered 2 of those fumbles while recording 15 tackles. Sandler had 11. Jared Brinkman had a strip sack with Tim Butcher recovering that fumble. Caden Hoftelling had 2.5 tackles for loss from his defensive end position. UNI had not scored 6 turnovers in a game since it forced 6 in 2012 against Division II Central State. Quote, "Honestly, it was a lot of fun," Cuvillier said. "It was playing team football." That was the big halftime speech from Farley, was coming together. "The third and fourth quarters, we came together and played our butts off," unquote. UNI opened the scoring after Cuvillier recovered a Asher O'Hara fumble on the Hornet 23. After Williams converted a short 3rd-and-3 run, McShane scored on his very first carry as a Panther, a 13-yard run. Left tackle Trevor Penning cleared the way with a pancake block on the left edge. but Sac State would use three Kyle Sentwoski field goals to take a 9-7 halftime lead. The Panthers twice had golden opportunities to add to its early lead. After a Benny Sapp interception, Will McIlvain fumbled inside the Hornet 30 early in the second quarter. Then, with 3 minutes left to the half, Matthew Cook passed a 38-yard field goal wide left after you and I had driven 60 yards all on the ground. Quote, "It was a frustrating first half," Farley said. "We didn't have any energy. We were all frustrated in the first half. We were just slow. The heat, and it was hot, and the travel magnified it." Quote, "It was not a fun first half. It was a very adverse situation where we were expecting a lot of energy and not making much progress. But we got it up and did a good job. A tremendous road win. We are a worn football team, but a happy football team," unquote. Now, in NASCAR, Gibbs Stable asserting itself two races into Cup playoffs. Story filed by Hank Kurtz of the Associated Press. Richmond, Virginia. Two races into the NASCAR Cup Series playoffs, regular season champion Kyle Larson is still the points leader, but the stable of contenders at Joe Gibbs Racing is making the most noise with victories in the last two races. Martin Truex Jr. led a 1-2-3 parade of JGR Toyotas to the checkered flag on Saturday night at Richmond Raceway, and it wasn't just at the finish line where they dominated. Not much past the race's midpoint, they were running 1-2-3-4. The return to winning ways is perfectly timed. Truex's teammate Danny Hamlin, who finished second at Richmond, ended a 31-race winless drought in the playoff opener at Darlington, and Truex's victory, while his fourth of the season, came in his 16th start since the last one. It was during that winless spell that Larson really asserted himself, winning four times. Quote, "Summer was tough," Truex said. "We had a lot of tough luck and a lot of crashes and got caught in the rain a few times. Some crazy things happened to us," unquote, like Hamlin the week before. Truex seemed to feel like a return to victory lane was all but inevitable based on his overall performance, despite the drought. Quote, "In general, I think we felt good coming into the playoffs. We got a lot of questions about how we felt our team, and I was straight up saying that I felt good about it. We had speed, and our guys were doing a great job," he said. Larson, like Truex, needed to rally from the back. The Hendrick Motorsports star was sent to the back of the field before the race started for twice failing pre-race inspection. Truex got sent to the back too on the opening lap when NASCAR determined that he took off before the pole sitter, Hamlin. But Larson said expecting to win even before the penalty would have been unreasonable, especially because the 0.75-mile oval has vexed him a bit. He finished 18th in Virginia's capital in the series' first stop in the spring. Quote, "As bad as we were last time, we were here. I think to have a win in your expectations would be difficult to do," Larson said after finishing sixth. Quote, "I think we exceeded what I thought we would do here," unquote. Hamlin, meanwhile, did not. He had the most dominant car for much of the race, just like he did in the spring, and failed to cash in with a victory in either. He led 197 laps on Saturday and won both stages, just as he had in April when he led 207 laps. Momentum, though, for him and his teammates is a positive. Quote, "It's a go time now. Ultimately, it's the time where you've got to bring your best. JGR had fast cars for all of us today, and I really wish we would have got two in a row. But regardless, still a great day for our team," he said. Christopher Bell finished third, and all three could have been witnesses to a victory by teammate Kyle Busch if Busch hadn't made a bad mistake. With about 50 laps to go, during green flag pit stops, he got caught speeding while entering pit road and was given a pass-through penalty. That dropped him back to 10th, still with plenty of time to make up the ground, but he didn't. His teammates were just that good. Now let's continue reading local news. In a column on the opinion page filed by Aaron Murphy, Finkenauer says voters want a change. Abby Finkenauer has her sights set on Chuck Grassley. But in order to take on Iowa's longtime Republican U.S. Senator, assuming he runs for re-election next year, Finkenauer, the former Congresswoman and state legislator, and now Democratic candidate for U.S. Senate, first must navigate a Democratic primary. In an interview after a recent campaign event, Finkenauer talked about what she believes Iowa Democrats are looking for in their candidate to try to climb Iowa's politics' seemingly unclimbable mountain, defeat Chuck Grassley. She also offered her thoughts on what message Democrats need to deliver to voters in order to end their statewide top-of-the-ticket losing streak. Grassley has not yet announced whether he will run for re-election to an 8th 6-year term in the U.S. Senate. He would be 89 years old when sworn in to another term. Jim Kierlin, a Republican state legislator from Northwest Iowa, has announced his campaign, but he would be an even longer shot to defeat Grassley in a Republican primary. Grassley has been winning elections in Iowa for as long as Alaska has been a state. And if Democrats haven't had any luck beating Grassley over the past 6 decades, their luck in recent statewide races at the top of the ticket has not been any better. Iowa Democrats have not won a U.S. Senate or gubernatorial race since 2008. So the odds would seem to be against the Democrats if Grassley runs. But speaking after receiving the endorsement of an Iowa firefighters union last past week, Finkenauer exuded confidence. Quote, folks really know that it's time for a change. It's time for somebody who's going to do it for the right reasons and get things done, Finkenauer said. Quote, and that's what it's always been about for me. It's about the job. It's about the people. It's about the work, and it's about making sure that working families have a voice in D.C. to push back against folks at the top who continually try to push working families down and divide us. I'm tired of division, and so are people across the state, unquote. The other announced candidates for U.S. Senate are Manning farmer Dave Mulbauer and Minden physician Glenn Hurst. Sioux City veteran Mike Franken is expected to announce his candidacy this fall. Finkenauer now lives in Cedar Rapids, must introduce herself to a statewide audience for this Senate campaign. She represented a portion of Dubuque in the legislature, then Eastern Iowa's 20-county 1st Congressional District for a single 2-year term in the U.S. House. The early stages of her campaigning have already taken her to Council Bluffs and Sioux City, as well as Southeast Iowa, Finkenauer said. In the primary, Finkenauer believes Democrats want a candidate who can talk about kitchen table issues such as, quote, the difference between being able to make a living and a good life and how that has changed in our country over the years, unquote. She repeated her call for an end to divisiveness, especially through conspiracy theories. Quote, that is not who we are, Finkenauer said. And I believe we're not just Democrats, but no party voters and even Republicans across the state want someone who's willing to step up against the lies, against the division, and just get things done for them, unquote. Iowa's 2022 primary election is June 7th, and the general election is November 8th. Next, in a story filed by Andrew Wind, University of Northern Iowa holds its place in annual U.S. News rankings. Cedar Falls. The University of Northern Iowa is holding steady in an annual ranking of Midwestern regional public universities. UNI came in second on the list of the 2022 U.S. News Best Colleges rankings. It was topped by Missouri's Truman State University, while Grand Valley State University of Michigan held the third place spot. A total of 52 Midwest regional public universities are on the top public schools list. All three universities held the same rank a year ago, and Truman State was also first in 2020, one spot ahead of UNI. The rankings, released last week by U.S. News and World Report, rate 1,466 American colleges and universities on 21 different lists. Princeton University in New Jersey is number one among national universities, and Williams College in Massachusetts is in the top spot among national liberal arts colleges. For top public schools, the University of California, Los Angeles, is number one among national universities. The United States Naval Academy ranks first for top public schools among national liberal arts colleges. Each of those schools were in the number one spot last year as well. Multiple divisions are included on the top public schools list. Rankings are divided by national universities and liberal arts colleges and regional universities and colleges. The regional categories are divided by North, South, Midwest, and West. U.S. News characterizes regional universities as offering a full range of undergraduate programs and providing graduate education at the master's level. This is similar to national universities, which include the University of Iowa and Iowa State University, 33rd and 58th on that section of the top public schools list. According to information on the rankings, though, regional universities differ from their national counterparts by offering few, if any, doctoral programs. In many cases, national universities also place a stronger emphasis on research and receive federal money to support those endeavors. Of 596 regional universities that were ranked, 245 are public, 341 are private, and 10 are for profit. On the best regional universities list for the Midwest, which includes public and private institutions, UNI was tied with four other institutions for 19th place, up one spot from its ranking of 24th last year. Upper Iowa University in Fayette, which has a Waterloo campus, is ranked with other Midwest regional universities in the 119 to 157 range. It was also ranked in a similar range last year. Wartburg College in Waverly is ranked 165 on the National Liberal Arts Colleges list, in a tie with two other schools, three spots lower than last year. A total of 222 National Liberal Arts Colleges are ranked this year. Those on the list emphasize undergraduate education and award at least 50% of their degrees in liberal arts disciplines. The organization gave UNI a score of 73 out of 100, using 17 indicators related to academic excellence. The university had an average first-year retention rate of 84%, a six-year graduation rate of 63%, and a student-faculty ratio of 17 to 1. On class sizes, 44% were under 20 students, and 4% had 50 or more. On the Best College for Veterans list, UNI is tied for 9th with two other institutes among 50 Midwest regional universities. That is up from 17th place last year. Now we have time for one or two letters to the editor. Hooray for DSPs! Direct Support Professional Recognition Week, September 12th through the 18th, is a week set aside to recognize and celebrate the hardworking, dedicated, direct support workforce that is at the heart of services for over 160,000 Iowans with disabilities. Largely unrecognized, DSPs are more than just support staff. They are advocates, protectors, teachers, cheerleaders, and integral to life in our communities for persons served by North Star Community Services and countless other agencies across the country. Thank you, DSPs, for your compassion, dedication, and commitment. The work you do does not go unnoticed. Please join us as we continue to celebrate the talent and success of our outstanding DSPs who continue to make a difference in the lives of those we support and their families daily. We couldn't do it without each and every one of our DSPs, not only this week, but throughout the year. Be proud of the work you do and the difference you make. On behalf of North Star Community Services, thank you. signed by Jody Muller of Cedar Falls. Next, vaccines work. Vaccines eliminate rubella, polio, measles, hepatitis, shingles, and mumps, saving hospitalization costs. Masks worn by surgeons and nurses protect us from infections during operation. Stop signs, stop lights, seat belts, and driving on the right side of the road keep us safe and save money. The great company where I worked requires drug tests, earplugs, safety glasses, gloves, and shoes to protect employees and save money. Only stupid people don't understand. I'm so happy you are not one of them. Signed by Denny Mills of Cedar Falls. Driving Division. Some time ago, there was an editorial that stated Dr. Walter Cunningham was the president of the NAACP and worked closely with former police chief Barnell Cornson to build community relationships. Though Cunningham never served as president of the Blackhawk County NAACP, he was well respected and a great community leader. In addition, there have been past NAACP presidents, including myself, that worked hard to build relationships with the Waterloo Police Department, and the NAACP is still doing so today. Likewise, there is a new generation of young community activists and leaders that are working just as hard to build community relations. However, where do you stand on the issues now? And that does it for today's reading of the Waterloo Cedar Falls, The Courier, for Monday, September 13th. I'm your reader, Bob Young. You can access a recording of today's reading on our website, iowaradioreading.org, at any time. And you may wish to stay tuned to the reading of the Dubuque Telegraph Herald, which follows shortly. This is Iris, and thanks for listening today.